So there is a new video doing the rounds on various platforms that pushes back against this popular story about the Jews from Morocco, because for years and years and years we've heard that this, we've heard a really nostalgic narrative about a perfect coexistence, that Jews lived in harmony and they left voluntarily and that their departure was just part of modern migration. This video is absolutely fascinating because it challenges that entirely. It's kind of goes on to say that the discrimination, the pressure, the fear that shaped Jewish life in Morocco is exactly what caused this mass exodus in the late 40s. It asks the tough question, who gets to tell this history, and why has the Jewish side of the story been softened or erased? So to have that discussion with me this afternoon, I'm so pleased to be joined again by Lynn Julius. Lynn, great having you with me on Chai FM.
Great to be with you. Thank you, Simon.
So, Lynn, before we even get into the details about the video, when you look at the story of the Jews from Morocco and how they're spoken about today, what's the biggest misunderstanding you hear from people who think that they know the full history of the Jewish immigration from Morocco?
Well, the Jewish community in Morocco was the largest, actually, in the Arab world. It was about almost 300,000 of them. The biggest misunderstanding, I would say, is there wasn't that much anti-Semitism in Morocco. Mm. There's also a myth that the king protected them during World War II, saved them from being deported to Nazi concentration camps. So what's complicating the picture is actually the fact that relations between Morocco and Israel have actually been pretty good, despite the mass exodus of the Jews. There's been a royal advisor called André Azoulay. He's an advisor to the king. And the king himself has been preserving a lot of Jewish heritage, restoring synagogues and sure that Jewish cemeteries are well looked after, that sort of thing. And of course, relations between Jews and Moroccans have actually never been ruptured, unlike other Arab countries. For instance, Iraq, Jews from Iraq can't go back there. Jews from Libya can't go back there. But Jews from Morocco can go back, and thousands travel there every year. So the picture's been kind of confused, if you like, about why Jews actually left Morocco.
So I find it incredibly confusing because on the one hand, it's absolutely true what you say. I've read about the thousands and thousands of Jews who visit Morocco each year. I believe up until recently, up until the Abraham Accords, there was a fiction that Israeli Jews had to take a plane to Paris first because they weren't allowed to arrive from Israel. I mean, I think it was the biggest open secret in the planet. But that was one side. The second thing, and sorry if I'm talking too much here, I just want to get it out quickly, is the fact that I don't know where else in the Arab world it seemed so popular. Part of the local Muslim culture that apparently, and correct me if I'm wrong, but apparently local Muslims used to pray at the tombs of dead Jewish rabbis asking for miracles and help. So it seems as if Jewish life was in fact intertwined into the very fabric of Morocco. However, and this is the part I want to get to, I read a book not too long ago talking about the Jews of North African descent, and there was some traveler who went to Morocco in the 1800s or thereabout, and what he described, Lynn, was abject humiliation. How the Jews lived there was just awful. These were people who had been cowed, who had absolutely begun to believe their dhimmi status. Now, where's the truth? Because what I've said to you now are two very different things happening at the same time. Praying at dead rabbi graves and living in dhimmitude.
Yeah, well, actually, the two things can be true at the same time. There was definitely a cultural symbiosis. The Jews were sort of looked up to for their spirituality, if you like. And they even were thought to have magical powers. Like, for instance, when a sultan was on his deathbed, yes, he would summon rabbis to pray for his recovery. So there was that, and as you say, the shared worship at saints' tombs, rabbis' tombs. But on the other hand, the dhimmi status, which you described, was absolutely true. The Jews were had an inferior status to Muslims, and they were continuously humiliated. I'd say that their situation was the worst of any Jewish minority in the Arab world. And it was actually made worse by the fact that they were the only minority, non-Muslim minority in North Africa, because the Christians had actually been wiped out in the 12th century. And the Jews, although they'd been persecuted, they actually did survive in Morocco, but they survived really under terrible conditions. They were, for instance, locked up in walled ghettos called mellahs, and this sort of thing didn't really exist anywhere outside Morocco. The first mellah was built in Fez in 1438. And actually, if you look at the historical record, Morocco was the worst country for pogroms or, you know, disturbances. The Jews had to wear special clothing, which marked them out from the Muslims. They had to go barefoot in front of mosques. And, you know, these sort of humiliations and restrictions didn't operate for Jews in other countries in the Middle East.
It seems so incredibly arbitrary from the history that I remember reading. It just so seemed dependent on the particular ruler at the time and his disposition to the Jewish community at that particular time. It just seemed as arbitrary as all that. Would that be a correct reading of the situation or not?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that was the essence of being a dhimmi, really. It was insecure, it was precarious, and it depended on the ruler of the day. And you had rulers who were benevolent and treated their Jews well, and you had other rulers who did not. And you just did not know what the future would bring. I'd have to say that the essence of being a dhimmi as well was to pay a special tax.
The jizya.
And of course, the jizya tax, exactly. And of course, the ruler valued their Jews as a source of income. So, you know, obviously he did need them, you know, not to survive, so that he had that source of income. But at times of war or instability, he wanted to impose even more taxes on them. And you know, that would lead to of extreme oppression, and you know, the Jews did suffer at that time.
So, Lynn, I'm presuming in your social networks or in your milieu, you get to meet Moroccan Jews, or you've met Moroccan Jews, and I'm wondering, at what point the older generation tell you they knew it was time up? At what point did they realize they weren't fully welcome as Jews in Morocco, and then decide to pack their bags?
Yeah, it's very interesting, because the sort of Moroccan Jews I've come across really are kind of quite middle class. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them would say, we had a very nice life in Morocco. And, you know, we had nice houses and we had servants and everything was wonderful. But those Jews who went to Israel tended to be Jews who were living in mixed cities, did not have any kind of privileges, were often beaten up, you know, in the streets. You know, it was like two types of Jews, those who were kind of insulated from the outside world and lived in a bubble, the more prosperous, comfortable ones, or the ones who were really in the Jewish quarters or the mellahs, who could have quite a bad time of. And I'd say most of those Jews came into that latter category, and those are the ones who ended up in Israel. So they have a very different memory, I think, of life in Morocco to those who ended up maybe in the West, or in France, in Britain, in Canada.
What is striking is if one goes to Israel, well, you can barely, well, it's impossible to go to Israel and not feel the very significant influence of Moroccan Jews, whether it is from things such as Mimuna, the celebration of the Pesach, to the food, to the music. I mean, it's in every single aspect of Israeli life. And you wonder why it was so important to them to remain loyal to these cultural traditions when they were treated so incredibly badly there. How does one deal with that cognitive dissonance?
Yeah, well, you're right. I mean, there is a very rich, there was a very rich Jewish life in Morocco. But the two things, again, are true at the same time. You can have a very rich internal life and a rich culture, and you can have those wonderful ceremonies, like the henna ceremonies with the bride decked up in this sumptuous... you can have all that, and yet you can have a threatening outside world, if you like. So the anti-Semitism existed alongside this very rich cultural life. So what they've done is they've preserved their cultural life. And they're about 15% of the Jewish population in Israel.
No, I'm really grateful we had this conversation, Lynn, because accepted wisdom is that they sort of went to Israel of own volition. One forgets the push factors that were so very definitely part of the story as well. It seems like there's certain vested interests who have a reason to tell the story in the way that they are telling it. Lynn Julius, always such a pleasure having you with us on the Home Run on Chai FM. We'll chat again soon, I'm sure. Thank you for your input this afternoon.